Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can be done to help people harmed by extraordinary tragedies? And why does our society rush to compensate victims of certain disasters while leaving others to fend for themselves? Many of us feel sympathy when terrible things happen to innocent people, but only in certain situations are we moved to direct public funds or private donations to try and make things better for those affected. My guest today has considered both the social and legal aspects of such cases, and he's here to talk about them. Attorney Kenneth R. Feinberg served as administrator of the 9/11 Victim Compensation Fund and was also involved in compensation programs for the victims of the Virginia Tech shooting, the Deepwater Horizon spill, and other cases. His new book is called Who Gets What? Fair Compensation After Tragedy and Financial Upheaval. Kenneth, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Is this all about justice in the classic sense of the word or something else?
Oh, I don't think it's about justice in the classic sense. I think instead it's about the American character in certain situations, a desire on the part of the American people in certain limited situations to come to the financial rescue of those innocent victims.
And we feel better about ourselves if we come to the rescue.
That's the key, you see. It's hard to justify providing billions of dollars in taxpayer money to help the victims of 9/11, and yet not a dime of taxpayer money to help the victims of Oklahoma City or Katrina or the first World Trade Center attack in 1993. Mm-hmm. This is about a strain in the American character that certain disasters so galvanize the American people that they want to reach out and help others.
And I suppose to a certain extent it's something that we have to accept about ourselves and understand will happen on occasion, but we can't expect it to happen every time.
That's exactly right. Bad things happen to good people every day in this country. And there is not a 9/11 fund or a BP oil spill fund or a Virginia Tech scholarship fund. It's when the American people decide, you know, this is different. This is unique. This is particularly tragic. Let's show our resolve with our fellow Americans.
Some people have commented on the fact that there have been funds established, and I don't know whether you have any deep knowledge about this, but for the victims of the Aurora shootings, for those who have medical bills to try and take care of those, some critics have noted that people shot in the same city by other people on the same day don't get that kind of help.
There you are, you see. Aurora has sort of preoccupied the American people. And the American people, the charitable strain in many Americans, they send in checks. They send in dimes and dollars and money to help Aurora, help Aurora, help Aurora. Well, they don't send in that money to help other victims of shootings. And yet, here is this money. It's private money. It's donated charitably. It should be distributed to those in need.
Talk a little bit about how this line of work became your specialty. Your first big compensation case involved U.S. troops who'd been hurt by exposure to Agent Orange.
That's right. That was a lawsuit brought in the 1980s by Vietnam veterans who claimed that they were suffering all sorts of illnesses and injuries due to their exposure to the herbicide Agent Orange dropped by the U.S. Air Force to help them. During the Vietnam War, and after the war was over and they came home, they found that they were suffering of these injuries. They brought a lawsuit, and the judge asked me to get involved to help settle the dispute and distribute the money, and that was sort of the game changer in terms of my professional career.
And so suddenly you're involved in this area of legal practice that is, I mean, they're all complicated, but incredibly complicated because first and foremost, you have to set up parameters to determine who qualifies for benefits, and then you have to decide what those benefits will be.
That's exactly right. Who's eligible? What's the formula for calculating awards? What are the proof requirements in order for you to succeed in filing a claim? Mm-hmm. And all of this has to be sorted out. How much money is there to distribute? And how will you allocate it among eligible claimants?
And you have to know that there will be people who probably don't deserve benefits that receive them, and some who might, in fact, deserve them that don't qualify.
Absolutely. You have to recognize that anybody who designs and administers these programs, we are fallible. The goal is to try and minimize the number of errors, maximize the speed and generosity of these programs, like 9/11, like BP, get the money out the door as fast as you can, and hope that the number of ineligible claimants or even fraudulent claimants can be kept to a minimum.
What do you learn each time one of these cases has been concluded and the funds have been tapped out in terms of how you can do it better next time?
Well, every one of these is different, of course. What you learn is, first of all, that the cases, that the compensation systems are different. They involve different issues. But you learn that the key is to try and deal with the emotional reaction of innocent victims who believe in good faith that every ill they suffer, financially, socially, medically, it's all due to the tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
That's human nature. They're not lying. They're not trying to game the system. Some are, but most people emotionally in good faith believe, but for this tragedy, I would have been and my family would have been much better off.
And in some cases, it's impossible to say whether that is, in fact, correct or incorrect.
Most of the time, it's impossible to say that.
Mm-hmm.
The law recognizes that you try and do the best you can at requiring some evidence that the world would have been much brighter and more optimistic and you would have succeeded but for the tragedy. But it's all, you know, a murky crystal ball. We saw that with 9/11 and BP. You don't know for sure. And you do the best you can.
Does it speak to a certain kind of American blind faith in the system that we assume, at least with these very large tragedies, that, someone may come along and, rescue us, at least to the extent that it's possible financially?
I think that's right, especially your caveat. Here in the United States, since the founding of the Republic, money has been used to compensate eligible people. It's money. Some societies, maybe it isn't money. Maybe it's a thank you or barter or we'll help with your home or we'll help farm the land or whatever. But here in the United States, financial compensation is the vehicle. Every day in every court in our country, financial compensation is awarded by wrongdoers to innocent victims. And that basically is what we do here in the United States with these very rare compensation programs like 9/11 and BP.
Yeah, and we'll talk about BP in a moment. 9/11 is interesting because you have innocent victims being compensated by, in this case, a fund set up by Congress, as opposed to the people who were directly responsible for this tragedy. And that sets up a whole different set of questions.
It's unique in American history. I know of no case, none, where the Congress stepped up and appropriated money, public taxpayer money, not private money. This is all taxpayer money. Mr. Feinberg, design the program, compensate the families of lost loved ones, compensate those physically injured by the terrorist attacks, pay it quickly, tax-free, and get that money to these eligible claimants because we as a nation want to show our empathy and our help for these innocent victims.
So how did you decide how much money would go to, let's just say, each the family, the surviving family of each person who was killed?
Well, Congress sort of mandated that everybody get a different amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
Congress said, Ken, you should do, in effect, Congress said, Mr. Feinberg, in designing and administering this compensation program, you should do what judges and juries do every day in every city, village, and hamlet in this country. What would the victim have earned over a lifetime but for the attacks? How much should be added for pain and suffering and emotional distress? And calculate the damages like you're the judge and the jury and issue the awards. And that's exactly what we did quite successfully, I might add.
Mm-hmm. Of course, there is the irony that those who had the greatest lifetime earning potential were much more likely to have been adequately insured to care for their families than those who were, say, working as a busboy at Windows on the World.
You're right, Chris, and that's why Congress in the statute said that before I issue an award to anybody in 9/11, I must deduct life insurance and other collateral compensation, workers' compensation awards, so that the net amount takes into account the fact of outside sources of other income.
Did anybody turn the money down?
Yes. 97% of all eligible families took the money. Mm-hmm. 94 families decided voluntarily, nope, we don't want to take this money. We would rather sue the airlines and the World Trade Center and the security guard companies and Massport and the Port Authority of New York. We'd rather sue and litigate. And so 3% turned down the money. They sued. And eventually, 5 or 6 years later, they all settled those lawsuits as well.
Are lawsuits in such cases inherently bad for the situation, for healing, for justice?
No, I wouldn't say they're inherently bad. It's the American way, I must say. Lawsuits are the common vehicle for rectifying wrong in our country. It's the rule of law. It's the way we do things. And it is very rare indeed, very rare, that you get a 9/11 fund, a BP oil spill fund, some other alternative compensation mechanism to pay victims. Usually, you go to court.
So are these funds, in a way, sparing all involved the pain and anxiety of going to court over this?
Yes. One of the great advantages of these funds is that without a lawsuit, without hiring a lawyer, without going to court and litigating for years and years, with an uncertain result, I might add, you can instead, if you're eligible, opt in to a 9/11 fund and be paid within 90 days, a total award, tax-free, without taking 25 or 30% to pay your lawyer. So it's an alternative mechanism, but it's very rare indeed that you see anything like the 9/11 fund.
So one thing that people do get if they take something to court is quite literally their day in court, their opportunity to speak about what they have lost and how they have suffered. And this is something that you have come to believe is vital regardless of the mechanisms by which people are compensated.
I think it's very rare that a person gets their day in court. Even the 94 people who opted out of the 9/11 fund settled their cases. They never got their day in court. They resolved their case 5 years later, just like they could have resolved it in the 9/11 fund. What I do agree with, however, is the idea, the critical importance of giving people an opportunity to be heard. So in the 9/11 fund, we gave any family or any physically injured victim the option of coming to see me under oath and explaining their story, what was on their mind, their frustrations, their anger, their disappointments. All of that was allowed and was very harrowing, I must say.
My guest is attorney Kenneth R. Feinberg. He is was the administrator of the 9/11 Victim Compensation Fund. He was also involved with compensation for the Virginia Tech shooting, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, and other cases. We're talking this hour about his new book, Who Gets What? Fair Compensation After Tragedy and Financial Upheaval. We'd love to have your questions and your input on this subject. Give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is attorney Kenneth R. Feinberg. We're talking about his new book, Who Gets What? Fair Compensation After Tragedy and Financial Upheaval. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Kenneth, for those victims and survivors who chose to tell you their stories that, as you mentioned, were very harrowing, understandably, what did you find in common that they wanted the world to know about what they had experienced?
It's very interesting. I found that virtually nobody came to see me to talk about money. Nobody came to argue or assert a brief for additional compensation or more compensation. Practically everybody, virtually everybody, wanted to come to see me to validate the memory of a lost loved one. Mr. Feinberg, I lost my wife at the World Trade Center. We were married for 25 years. She was an angel. And at this hearing, I'd like to show you a video of our wedding 25 years ago. Medals, diplomas, certificates of good conduct, ribbons. People came with paraphernalia, with memorabilia to assert the memory of somebody, taken from them on a moment's notice during the 9/11 attacks. And you find how human nature deals with tragedy. People came to talk to me about the person who was gone and was no longer around.
Many of these people, in multiple tragedies that you cope with in the book, might have had the opportunity to tell those stories through the media. And I have to wonder whether anyone expressed to you whether they feel like that avenue isn't so good, that that's really about the audience rather than about the people telling the story.
I think that's right. That's a very good point. Most people who came to see me after 9/11 came in confidence. They did not want their personal, private thoughts about the victims spread all over the newspapers or TV. They wanted to sort of one-on-one in a private, confidential hearing validate that memory without the public intervening.
All right, let's talk about BP's Deepwater Horizon spill and the fund that was established. Why, first of all, did BP decide to put money out up front rather than waiting for people to sue them for damages?
Well, you can look at it two ways. One way is you can say you try saying no to President Obama. President Obama quickly took BP to the woodshed and said, look, the conventional way of doing things with lawsuits, et cetera, not this time. This is too momentous a tragedy, and the White House is looking for BP to step up and think out of the box. But you can also see why BP thought it was a real advantage. Let's immediately set up a $20 billion fund. Let's get some credible, independent person to run the program, and let's try and buy up as many potential lawsuits as possible. We don't want to go the route of Exxon Valdez. They're still litigating that case over 20 years later since the Alaskan spill, oil spill. So BP made a business decision. We want certainty. We want to get out of the courtroom. We want to pay eligible claimants. We want our shareholder price, our stock price to rise. We don't like the uncertainty of litigation. So I think it was a win-win for everybody.
It's interesting because a lot of people felt that President Obama overstepped his boundaries.
Well, maybe. I mean, the president didn't put a gun to BP's head. I think BP saw some real wisdom in doing this. But what President Obama didn't want to see, I suspect, is a convoluted Exxon Valdez repeat performance, where for 20 years, people who were injured by the spill are waiting and waiting and waiting for their money. And in the first 18 months of the oil spill fund, before the first lawsuit was even scheduled, the oil spill fund distributed over $6 billion to over 200,000 people. So I think President Obama, I mean, frankly, just as President Bush deserves a great deal of credit for the 9/11 fund, President Obama gets high grades, very high grades, for setting up or helping BP set up an independent fund where BP had no say whatsoever on any individual claim.
Since we've talked earlier, Kenneth, about the importance of victims being given a chance to talk about their grievances and have them put on the record, how significant a problem was it that at least initially the response from BP's CEO seemed callous?
Oh, I don't think that's right at all. I think that the response from, well, you mean
the famous
Tony
quote,
Hayward.
Right, exactly, where
Tony
he said.
Hayward, well, that's before President Obama and the fund were set up.
Yeah.
But I think BP, to its credit, once a program was set up, immediately fronted the $20 billion to get money out to people as fast as possible. And once the money started to flow, and once it became apparent that the oil spill fund was paying claims in the first 90 days of the spill, the fund paid out almost $2.5 billion. So I think that once the money started to flow and people realized that there was a source of funding here, I think it became apparent that it was a very credible and a very worthwhile and constructive program.
What sort of challenges arise when there are, as in the case of the BP oil spill, close to 500,000 claims filed?
Well, that's not filed. That's paid. We received, here's the challenge, Chris, we received in the first 18 months over 1 million claims from 50 states and 35 foreign countries. When BP announced $20 billion, build it and they will come. So the challenge in the oil spill fund was, A, the sheer magnitude of the claims, the volume of claims, coupled with the fact that in hundreds of thousands of instances, people file claims with no documentation, no proof,
yeah,
no tax returns, no documentation that they were damaged. So it became a very difficult challenge processing claims and determining who's eligible and how much they ought to be paid.
And then, of course, you have to set that bar so that people are required to provide some evidence that they were, in fact, negatively affected by this incident. On the other hand, you don't want to set the bar so high that people have to hire a lawyer and really have expert help in receiving any compensation for valid claims.
Absolutely right. It's a real challenge. What are the requirements for compensation that will make the program attractive as an alternative to lawsuits, that will demonstrate generosity and speed, but at the same time is not open season? Anybody and everybody file claims. We receive claims from fishermen and shrimpers and oyster harvesters, fine. But we also receive claims from dentists, chiropractors, veterinarians, Europeans in Sweden and Norway. We received about 400 claims from Massachusetts, 60 from Alaska. I mean, when people realize there's $20 billion to distribute, oh, what the heck, let's get creative and file a claim. And we have to process every one of those claims and decide whether they're eligible or not and how much they should get paid.
What amount that were ultimately determined ineligible, would you say, is it possible to even calculate? The ones that you would say people perhaps believe they were damaged but didn't have reasonable evidence as compared with those that were likely out-and-out fraudulent?
Oh, out of over 1 million claims, we concluded about 18,000 were fraudulent. Now, that's a lot of fraud, but it's relatively modest in light of how many claims we received.
Mm-hmm.
Most people complied with the rules. But there were a fair number of fraudulent claims. Some of those people have been indicted by the Department of Justice and have pled guilty or what have you. Then there were a huge number of claims, a huge number, hundreds of thousands, where people simply didn't have any evidence that they were damaged. Mr. Feinberg, I lost $100,000 because I couldn't go fishing because the commercial fishing grounds were shut down by the spill. Well, okay, Mr. Jones, show me. Oh, we do things with a handshake down here. I don't have any tax returns or corporate profit and loss statements or anything like that. We just do things here, Mr. Feinberg, with a wink and a nod. Well, that isn't going to... I'm not paying claims that can't be corroborated, at least minimal corroboration.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jerry in Denton. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Hi, Mr. Feinberg. I know, you know, I've kind of... You've been on my radar screen for a long time. You're a very thorough person, and I'll bet you have numbers that would answer this question. And it basically comes down to that small proportion of people in the 9/11 fund who decided they would have their day in court instead and sue on the basis of a tort. And it's really a two-part question. One part is, if you do that and somebody was killed and they have a loss of their lifetime, does the court automatically deduct their life insurance policy from any award? And then the basic question is, do you have numbers that show whether those people that decided to go to court or decided to file suit, how did they fare in terms of the amount of money that they received? Would they have received the same amount or less or a better amount, not just sooner, if they had taken the settlement?
A fabulous set of questions. I mean, you're on to something here. First, the settlement of the 94 people who decided to sue remains confidential. It's sealed. I can't tell you with any guarantee whether people who sued and then settled got more or less than they would have received under the 9/11 fund. I can say this. Probably some got more, some got less. But if you got more, don't forget you had to give 25% to your lawyer. I don't think in lawsuits that the life insurance was offset, so that would increase the amount you got in the lawsuit. But there's the costs of the lawsuit you have to pay, deduct. And then there's this issue, you know, of waiting 5 years to get paid. The time value of money is a factor here. People who got their money within 90 days under the fund get a check, they invest it, and they move on with their lives as best they can. Whereas a lawsuit is a constant reminder for years about the tragedy. So I think it's a mixed bag. I don't want to say, I can't assure you that people got more or less if they sued. I think it's a mixed bag, and there are pros and cons on that.
How did the executive compensation offered under the Troubled Asset Relief Program compare and contrast with the sort of physical disasters that you had?
Oh, it was altogether different, of course. My role as the PASAR was very unique. Congress passed a law. And the law simply said that these seven companies that received the most taxpayer money to stay afloat, GM and AIG and Citigroup and Bank of America, well, you got that money. We are now going to set up a new law, and the Secretary of the Treasury is appointing Feinberg. He will determine what you're going to get paid. The American people are creditors. We lent you this money. We're now going to determine, the government, exactly how much a corporate official should be paid. I don't think that's ever happened before in American history, and I doubt very much it'll ever happen again. That was a very unique program.
And a lot of those executives really seem to have a lot invested, not just financially invested, but emotionally invested in what they received.
That's absolutely right. You know, when I would sit with these individuals and say, look, we're going to give you 90% less cash than you received last year. It wasn't about material gain or anything. That, an extra automobile or a summer home or private school for the kids. No. That wasn't the argument. The argument I heard from them was, how dare you impugn my integrity, my self-worth, my own personal evaluation of my contribution to family and society. You are punishing me. Why? Why are you doing this? And it became very, very emotional.
I'll confess that it's hard for me to relate to that segment, small segment of the population that is able to sort of measure its value based on income. But does it make sense to you? People who arrive at that level, that has become their key measurement of self-worth?
Well, it doesn't make sense to you, Chris, and it doesn't make sense to me. But I assure you, individuals caught up in that Wall Street race to the top, you better believe that those individuals view compensation as the key litmus test, the barometer of self-worth. And whereas the public looks at the argument and says, how much money do you really need to own another automobile or have a summer home?
Mm-hmm.
That isn't the argument I'm hearing back from Wall Street. What I was hearing back from those individuals is, you're demeaning my own sense of self. And that made it very, very emotional.
Does that offer some insight into how these corporations got into this kind of trouble in the first place?
Well, I think it does. I think it does. I think that there is always has been, as you know, since we set up our nation, a real tension between Wall Street thinking and Main Street thinking. And that tension came to the front during my work as the Pazar.
My guest this hour is attorney Kenneth R. Feinberg. We're talking about his new book. It's called Who Gets What? Fair Compensation After Tragedy and Financial Upheaval. We welcome your input to this conversation and your questions to 1-800-933-5372. We're also taking emails at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is attorney Kenneth R. Feinberg. He is the administrator of the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund, the compensation fund from the Virginia Tech shooting, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, and various others. He's got a new book out called Who Gets What? Fair Compensation After Tragedy and Financial Upheaval. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Kenneth, one thing that you don't get to do as the administrator of this fund, of these funds, is to determine how people spend this money. And, for example, in the case of the Virginia Tech shooting, all this money pours in. People have this great outpouring of grief and sympathy. Some people suggested that maybe that money would best be spent creating a scholarship fund, and you said no.
Don't ever try and put yourself in the shoes of victims of tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ever try and assume I'm going to tell you what's a wise way to spend this compensation. What I've learned is that when compensation is administered and delivered to eligible people, what they do with it, how they use it, when they use it, whether they invest it or spend it, that is entirely up to them. During Virginia Tech, after the Virginia Tech shootings, the president of the university said, well, we ought to put the money into scholarship funds for each of the victims. And somebody else suggested, you know, we better do that because otherwise one family said they may take the money and celebrate or remember the death of a student by going to Disney World. I said, look, if a grieving family wants to take $200,000 or $250,000 and go to Disneyland, that is up to that family. Do not try and micromanage how this money should be distributed or spent.
Is it your sense that the money makes anything better?
Of course it does. It at least, it doesn't make a whole lot better, but at least the compensation usually provides one less thing to have to think about,
mm-hmm.
financial uncertainty. Money can never replace a lost loved one, a father, a mother, a sibling. In 9/11, I remember family after family saying to me, keep the money, bring my husband back, bring my wife back, you can have the money. So money serves a function, but you're absolutely right, implicit in your question, it doesn't rectify the wrong. That it cannot do.
What does it take to keep getting up every morning and hearing these stories and recognizing that the very best you can do will never quite be good enough?
Well, I must say, people ask me that all the time. You try saying no to President Obama or President Bush or Secretary Geithner.
Did you try to say no?
Pardon me?
Have you tried to say no?
Well, you don't get very far. Maybe no would be appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're asked to perform a service on behalf of the American people, and it's bipartisan. It's not a Democrat program or a Republican program or a liberal program or a conservative program. It's designed, I think, to exhibit the best in our character. It's torturous. It's very difficult. It's harrowing. It's gut-wrenching. But you do it, and you do it because it's a public service and you've been asked to do it.
I suppose the bipartisan nature of these agreements and these payouts alone speaks to how rare they really are in this world.
That's right. I mean, fortunately in our country, which frowns on elitism and special treatment for special people, these programs are relatively rare. And it's relatively rare that elected officials or policymakers come together and decide this is a special case. And I think that's a good thing, that it's rare, because, as I said earlier, bad things happen to good people every day, and you don't have a BP oil spill fund or a tax-free 9/11 fund. So you better be very careful in terms of how often you go to the well by setting up these programs.
So given that they are rare and they're often accompanied by great sentiment in addition to a recognition of great hardship and loss, should the people who set these programs up, in other words, come to you and say, put this together, should they feel no guilt about the fact that they, you know, such efforts do leave out a lot of people who might have been affected by similar tragedies and not compensated?
I don't know about guilt, but I do think that policymakers recognize we better be careful about how often we find an exceptional reason to do this, because you're never going to replace the existing legal system in our country. You're never going to have a 9/11 fund for everybody. Our courts and our judges and juries do a very good job, I think, overall in distributing and dispensing justice. So I think it's a good thing that lawmakers look at these programs and say, well, it was a very successful program. These special programs did compensate. They did their job. But let's not do it again. At least let's not do it quickly.
We have an email here from Juan in Dallas who wants to know if you've ever regretted awarding an amount of money to a family after meeting them.
No. No. That's an interesting point raised in the email. I never try and put myself in the shoes of families in grief. I remember once I made a terrible mistake during 9/11. I said to one grieving father who lost a daughter, I know how you feel. What a mistake. The father looked at me, he said, Mr. Feinberg, you have a tough job. It's not easy. I know how difficult it is for you to do what you're doing. Don't ever say to anybody, you know how I feel. You have no idea how I feel. So I don't regret, after I meet a family, compensating. I try to distance myself from whatever I'm hearing from that family in terms of how it impacts my calculations of damage.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Felix on the line now, calling from Maine. Hi, Felix.
Great show.
Thanks.
Question, if I can get an answer. I'm curious as to the group that decided to go to court instead of settle for the 9/11 fund.
Yes.
Were they of the higher earners, the lower earners, you know, the ones who would have received more compensation or less? Or
is it possible to generalize about that?
No. It's an interesting question. We know the answer to that question. They were not, as a group, the 94 people, they were not higher income or lower income, one occupation or another occupation. They were very diverse. You couldn't generalize with economic strata or anything like that. It was a more individualistic, emotional decision whether to go to court or not.
When you, I mean, there's been such a spate, unfortunately, recently of horrible mass attacks. When you hear about one of these cases in the news, are you able to say to yourself, even in the back of your mind, okay, something that took place in a religious institution is more likely to result in a fund to compensate victims than something that happened in a movie theater or vice versa?
No. Again, it's what sort of triggers the conscience of the American people in terms of sending in unsolicited charitable contributions like Aurora, or perhaps the Sikh Temple. Don't forget, Virginia Tech, Aurora, those are private contributions. Those are Virginia Tech. That was unsolicited private money. That wasn't taxpayer money.
Right.
BP was not public money. It was BP corporate money. 9/11 is unique. Public taxpayer money.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Remember, you can also send email to think@kera.org. Can you talk for a few minutes about the people who work for you and how you ensure that you have a team who understands your priorities and the things that you find important and are able to sort of be up to this work, not just intellectually but emotionally?
Well, that's a good question. I usually, for the four or five times I've been involved in these programs, I use as my key deputies the same people who have worked with me in the past, who know my thinking and are very creative and intelligent people as to how to set up these programs. And then I'll subcontract out to vendors, claims processors, claims adjusters, accountants, lawyers. I'll seek the very best people I can, and I'll interview them or I'll interview companies and decide who do I need at my side to implement the protocol and the directives. And I've been very fortunate to have very, very smart and very good people. And when I was the pay czar, of course, I had the best people imaginable in government, the U.S. Treasury. Who better than some of those civil servants who really knew all there was to know about private corporate pay?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Mike is on the line now in Flower Mound. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm curious. I recognize that the money for that they receive is tax-free, but if someone uses as support of their claim $100,000 in prior years and they haven't filed taxes, does the government use these records to go back and chase that money?
I have no idea. You'd have to ask the IRS. In BP, I had one fellow who filed a claim, and he said he lost $100,000 fishing. He couldn't fish. And I asked him to show me how he lost $100,000. Did he have prior tax years, tax returns? He said no. I said, well, that's all right. What do you have to document your claim? And he showed me corporate profit and loss statements and everything. And I concluded that he had documented the fact that he had lost $100,000 because he couldn't fish. So I said to him, I'm going to send you a check for $100,000, and with it, I'm sending you a IRS 1099 tax form. He said, well, I waive it. I go, you can't waive a 1099. I mean, I've got to send that to you. He said, you're going to send it? Yeah. He said, I withdraw my claim. I said, you mean to tell me I'm ready to send you a check for $100,000, but because I'm sending you a 1099, you're withdrawing your request? He goes, that's right. I don't want the IRS. I don't want a 1099. And he withdrew his claim. So I doubt very much the IRS would have gone after him, but he felt that he probably hadn't paid taxes in 15 years. So he withdrew his claim. So I think there were a lot of people who, in the BP oil spill fund, when they realized that there would be consequences to receiving the money, decided not to file or to withdraw their claims.
I think this book, Kenneth, is so fascinating because it raises so many interesting questions that you have to ask yourself. I wonder if you can talk about the questions you think all of us need to ask ourselves when we support or don't support special funds being set up for tragedies, and how we need to think about the choices that we make as a society.
Clearly, the first question, the ultimate question, is creating a special fund for a relatively small segment of innocent victims, sound public policy? That's the very first question. Because unless you decide, you know, 9/11 really is different. The BP oil spill fund really is different. Be careful about singling out people for special generosity and special treatment. Second issue. If we're going to create a fund, why? Why are we doing it now? Is it because of the victims? Is it because we'll feel better as a people? Why? Three, where is the money going to come from? Is it public taxpayer money? Is it private unsolicited charitable contributions? Is it corporate money? And how much money, in the aggregate, is going to be made available to people? I mean, it makes very little sense to send every victim $1.60.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got to come up with some realistic parameters if you go down this road. And then finally, what is it we hope to achieve by setting up special programs like this?
Need to jump in. We
What's
are out
message?
Of time.
What's the what are we doing? Why are we doing it? Those are the key questions that you have to think about.
The new book by Kenneth R. Feinberg is called Who Gets What? Fair Compensation After Tragedy and Financial Upheaval. Kenneth, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Just terrific. Thank you so much, Chris. I appreciate it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.